2011. My name is Doug Kelly. So glad you could join us. And of course, I'm here as always with Grant Rubendunst.
On the eve of Cinco de Mayo, Doug.
Yeah.
Yes, sirree. It'll be a good night for tacos and margaritas tomorrow.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I have tacos planned for tomorrow.
There you go, man. And to all our friends in Mexico, hey, happy.
Party on.
Cinco de Mayo. Yeah, man.
Well, we'd like to welcome everybody to the show tonight. We're going to be talking about historical research, which is a topic we have not had on the,
yeah,
on the show in over 150 episodes. And we're going to welcome those in our chat room, our live listeners, also those listening on the Inception Radio Network, and those in the chat room. I'll be following both chat rooms. If you have any questions, please type them in there. We're not going to be taking live calls tonight because Jamie is... our executive producer and call screener is up to no good. No, I don't mean
that. That sounds like the Jamie I know.
Yeah, they're preparing for a on-location broadcast, so he's tied up with that.
We certainly enjoyed hooking up with him on Friday night at his hot Skywatch. I really
enjoyed
that.
Yeah, talk about that. We had a chance, Grant and I had a chance to go and visit with Jamie and a bunch of other people at his place in Inglewood, Florida for Skywatch last Friday night. And Billy Cox from the Sarasota Herald Tribune was there. He's pretty well-known UFO blogger and into that part of it. In fact, he did a interview with me several years ago when we had Spirit Team. So he
I remember that paper.
And Morgan Bell... now with MUFON, and I believe, didn't he say he was a state director?
Yeah, we know Morgan all the way back to the days when we were both doing some paranormal research down at, what's the name of the hotel down
Clewiston.
There? Clewiston, yeah, which is a very cool place.
Mm-hmm.
And great people there.
Yeah, we had a chance to meet some other folks there as well. Didn't see anything exciting, but, you know, it was nice to catch up, and we had some interesting dialogues.
Talk about a place that's rich in history. It certainly is. Clewiston.
Yeah. So, that was cool. So tonight we have with us Elizabeth Egan Cox. She is into historical research and has got a lot of cool things and techniques that she's going to share with us. And she is hailing from Southern California. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you, Grant.
Oh, it's so nice to have you.
And, Doug, you get bonus points for pronouncing Egan correctly.
Oh. Well, it does have an EA in it, you know.
You're a man of many talents, a man of many talents.
You would be surprised. But, you know, I think, you know what? There could be a little bit of what I call blood memory here, and that's actually a very old Celtic theory. My clan, my Egan clan, which still has a castle in County Tipperary, Ireland, is called Redwood Castle. We are historically connected to the O'Kelly clan.
Ah, the O'Kellys.
There you go.
And I must admit,
the fine O'Kelly family.
There was a time in my life I thought, hey, you know, should I change my name to O'Kelly?
Uh-huh.
And I thought, nah, it probably too much work. So
well, it's like in the Irish is oh the equivalent of like Mac is in the Scottish.
Actually, so like, I'm sorry, I've got to cut you off there because Mac and Muck, which is just MC,
mm-hmm.
mean exactly the same thing whether it's Scottish or Irish.
Mm. Oh, okay,
oh,
cool.
Oh simply means of. So
okay.
That is of the Kelly clan.
Oh, that's cool.
I am a Muck Egan, if you want to pronounce it correctly, and I won't even go into the Gaelic spelling of it, but Mac, M-A-C, and then M-C is just a shorter version. It means that you are the grandchild of, in my case, I'm the grandchild of Mac Egan, and Mac means the grandparent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And if you ever want to go into, you know, Celtic genealogy and that kind of thing, I've got really, really good websites from being an official member of the Clan Egan. And in Ireland, we're an official clan. And we have a castle and we have a chieftain, and it's an official title.
Oh, cool.
You know, but we are historically connected to the Kellys.
In a great way? In a good way, right?
In a very good way.
Okay.
Yes,
I mean, yeah, I didn't want to, you know, we're fighting with swords and all that stuff.
No. In a very, very good way. We are connected to the Kellys and the O'Kennedys. We were actually what's called the Brion family of the O'Kennedys, and it was the O'Kennedys that gave us Redwood Castle, you know, 1,000 years ago or so. But that kind of goes into the science of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize we're getting a little bit off topic here.
I don't know. We kind of started historical research, though, didn't we?
Yeah.
It is. Very, very historical research because people often know me outside of being a novelist for two reasons. I'm in the Daughters of the American Revolution here in the United States. My family goes back to the James River area of 1600. And
wow.
On my father's side, I am a member of the Clan Egan from Redwood Castle, County Tipperary, Ireland. Now, the unique thing about the whole Egan thing is that we were among the very first clans to sign up, and this is not a promo, but it's just simply the truth, to sign up with Family Tree DNA. I have met personally with the founder of Family Tree DNA, Bennett Greenspan. My whole clan met with him. And the reason that we were kind of a guinea pig group is because our clan is so well documented in Ireland. And that's unique because of everything that has happened in Ireland for a clan to still even have a castle, let alone have official documentation in the government of Ireland, which also coordinates with England. Because anything that's in Ireland that has to be coordinated and documented when it comes to the clans is also in England. And this is where you get into the whole European heraldry kind of thing, where there are actual documents. Well, we had a really, really good paper trail from Ireland into the United States. It was my great-grandfather, James Egan, who came here in the 1840s. So it wasn't all that long ago. And we just decided we would be a really good test group for Family Tree DNA. We did this like 10 years ago.
Huh.
And I'm just pleased as punch to tell everyone that we have now gone back 25 generation markers.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, in the DNA evidence, and it all holds up to the paper trail. So whenever someone will ask me about doing genealogy, and especially if it has to do with a paternal surname. In my case, I did not do the DNA test. We had a clan rally in Dallas, Texas. We meet every 2 years somewhere in the world. And I was at the one in Dallas, Texas, and I brought the DNA test kit home to have my nephew, who is in his mid-20s, do it. He's the second son of my brother. So I'm a huge believer in the whole DNA thing.
So explain what that's about. So people take DNA tests to, how do you go back and do DNA back 25 generations?
Well, first of all, let me explain that one of the things that you learn is that exactly what a generation is to your surname group. Now, I knew that here in the U.S., from doing the genealogy here, that the Egan men tended to marry late. Even in the 1800s, they didn't marry until they were between about 28 years old to about 32. And so once you start to do these markers, and each marker is a generation, and you discover that there is this pattern, then, like for in our case, we've decided, as a group, we've decided that a generation marker for us means 30 years.
Hmm.
In some surname groups, it may be 25 years or 20 years, depending on the pattern of when the man going back in generation have married, and that's how it's decided. So it's all done through paternal DNA. It has to be done through the man in the family with the surname. Doing female DNA is a whole different kind of thing. You can't get really exact and pinpointed in. And basically, Bennett Greenspan explained to our group, it's like this. Paternal DNA or male DNA, if you think of DNA as being a rope, a twisted rope,
mm-hmm.
Well, paternal DNA is at the very center core going through that rope, and very little can impact it over time because the outside that's protecting it is the female DNA, and there's far more variables in that female DNA. So if you think of an intricately braided piece of rope that's very thick, you kind of get the idea how paternal DNA is, I hate to say it, guys, you're simpler.
Well, that's okay. That's all right.
I'm a complex.
That's fascinating, though. That's absolutely fascinating,
like,
then.
Yeah, it's like having a single scent fragrance instead of a blended fragrance. The female DNA is a blended fragrance, and so certain fragrant tone notes will fade after time, whereas the male DNA is a single scent. That's S-C-E-N-T, a single scent, and so it doesn't fade.
But isn't the female mitochondria, you know, like one of the ways that you can trace, I mean, ethnically, what, or, you know, where you originally came from? So, I mean, we know we all came out of Africa, but as to what you migrated from, I mean, I'm not trying to downgrade the importance of either, but I know that that does play a part, doesn't it?
Yeah, the female DNA, basically what the female DNA does is that it will categorize the female, and some of the females in the Egan have done this, to being basically the very first European females, which is what we are, or you might have the very first Asian females, the very first African, or I really kind of want to say Mediterranean. Because it isn't just going to be African. It may be anywhere within that cradle of civilization in the Mediterranean area. But it's not going to be a straight shot that you're going to get in the paternal DNA. The paternal DNA actually is the surname group. And so it goes, in my case, Egan, you know, all the way back through all the various spellings and mispronunciations of the name. But yeah, with the female DNA, it's like, I am so Celtic. I am I am Irish, I'm Scottish, I'm Welsh, and I'm English. There's really no other chance that I would be traced to any other than that very first European female DNA coming out of the general area of sort of Germany, France. If I had come from a racially blended family of different ethnic population groups, then I would probably have a far more interesting female DNA. It may show up that there was something in the German France area, and perhaps maybe way over in Eastern Asia, you know, something like that. You find the most interesting female DNA showing up in people here in America who have European coming out of the British Isles, which is the foundation of America, going back to the James River, and those that have intermarried later on, especially after World War II, and they may have Mediterranean, or even maybe sort of Eastern Asia, intermarriage there. and then you've got a really interesting kind of a racial blend, for lack of a better description. I kind of prefer the term ethnic population groups only because that is maybe more generic and it's less likely to cause a burr with someone. But technically, yeah, it would be a racial blend.
Do you know what's kind of nice about that, though, Elizabeth, is that the fact that if we're all blending, we're all going back into the common whole. So, I mean, at least here in this part, and I think that's really kind of nice, you know. So we go out, we diversify, and then it's almost like then you come back home in a strange sort of way.
It kind of reminds me of something that you find on graves out here in the U.S., and it was very, very popular during the whole millennium scare thing, and that's the Celtic snake. Okay, and the Celtic snake is the snake that's the circle that shows the head of the snake swallowing the tail. That simply means a rebirth.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the past comes back, so to speak. And in genealogy, we do have the saying that you have to know your past in order to know yourself.
Well, let's clarify. The organization that you used was, again, named?
Family Tree DNA. Family Tree, go ahead.
A website?
I don't have the website.
Okay.
I really didn't plan to talk about this.
Well, that's cool. Let me just ask you some quick questions about that, just for our listeners. Family Tree DNA?
Yeah.
Okay, it's probably something like that, .com or something. But this is an alternative to a site like perhaps Ancestry.com?
Yeah. You know, I cannot recommend Ancestry.com. I'm sorry. But
amen to that.
One of the problems that I have with Ancestry.com, and, I mean, you know, their commercials get people interested in doing it, but their commercials will say something like, you don't need to know, you know, who is your family. You just need to start the hunt. And it shows basically a person putting in their name, and then all of these little lineages or family trees come up. But what Ancestry.com does not really come out and say is that when you go on there and you put in someone's name and these family trees come up, you cannot be sure that any of that has been documented. Now, I'm a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR. And the thing is that with the DAR, which began in the 1800s, when children of Revolutionary War patriots were still alive, is that in order to be a member of the DAR, and this is true with the men's SAR, or Sons of the American Revolution, a person must document in direct lineage. And direct lineage is child parent, not aunt, uncle, or cousin. With hard evidential documentation, basically we are talking about vital records, and I'm talking about government marriage certificates, birth, death certificates, military records can be used to show marriage, death. It also, military records have to be used to prove proven the so-called patriots' involvement with the American Revolution of 1776. The reason this is so fresh in my mind is that, first of all my ancestry is Southern, and Southern ancestry is among the most difficult to get hard documentation for because so much has happened in the South. I mean, the tornadoes that are going on right now is a reminder of that. Records get destroyed very easily throughout the South due to weather conditions, disasters, and let's face it, the Civil War. I was the very first person in my family to do that connection, and I'm out here in California. It is not an easy thing to do, but if I can do it, anyone can do it, and to this day, I have documented my direct lineage to 4 men who were Revolutionary War patriots, 1 in Virginia, 2 in South Carolina, and 1 in North Carolina. And this is the kind of thing that Ancestry.com does not really put forth in a very straightforward manner, okay? The information that you can just type in a name and get on Ancestry.com cannot be used for hard evidential documentation. And to tell you the truth, I have gone on there and I have come up with information on my grandfather, who died in Los Angeles in 1942. I have his death certificate. I have a photocopy of his grave. And they have his name and his birth date wrong on so many family trees.
Mm.
And I have contacted these people and I said, look, I will scan and send you an image of his exact death certificate from Los Angeles County in 1942. I have it. If you will change that creation, I never hear back from them.
Well, they're like the fast food of, you know, genealogy. I mean, you know, I think that's for people who want instant gratification. And as we were talking a little bit before we went out on air, was having done a little bit of research myself, historical research, it's a lot of hard work.
It is a lot of hard work.
All right, let's get away from this a little bit. Let's get geared around. There's a couple of questions. And just for our listeners on the archive, that website is familytreedna.com. And just a couple of questions. Now, this obviously can be important, an important part of historical research.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything we've been talking about so far can be an important part of historical research if you're trying to go back. I mean, that just goes without saying. Let me just ask you a couple of questions from the chat rooms. This is from the Deception Radio Network chat room. Richard would like to hear a brief comment about what kinds of things that you are involved in. He understands you write about you write ghost novels. Do you write about DNA? Are you a ghost researcher? Do you write lecture about spiritual topics?
I do write a paranormal mystery series. It is a cozy mystery series. For those of you not familiar with the term cozy, think Agatha Christie, think Sherlock Holmes. There is a lot of historical research that goes into my series, because the amateur sleuth, a lady named Shannon Delaney, she deals with cold case files out here in out here in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, in book one, I introduced a ghost who's a lead character. And by the way, the ghosts that are characters in my book, they are real characters. They are not there for the novelty of it. And this is a perfect example. His name is Eric Blackthorne. He was a magician who lived in the 1800s, late Victorian era. And in order to give a really good background on Eric Blackthorne, I had to do a lot of research about Victorian era parlor magic, which is often called close-up magic. And to do that, I called upon some people at a place called the Magic Castle in Hollywood. The Magic Castle is the official home to the Union of Professional Magicians. And they, in turn, referred me to some really good book resources that dealt with Victorian-era magic tricks or close-up tricks. You know, today you would probably call these sleight of hand, because this was not trying to make an elephant disappear on TV.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, up-close magic, which is my favorite kind of magic. So I do put a lot of research into my characters because they need to have a solid background. I even draw family trees for them. The other thing that I do is that I am involved in the paranormal investigation community from the point of being I'm kind of their librarian. I do a lot of stuff behind the scenes for them, because I do have a treasure trove of free websites that can be used. And people who are serious about going out to do what I call ghost investigations, they need to concentrate on the person who the ghost was.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you've got to start with finding out where they're buried, how they died. Don't misinterpret, you know, how they died. I've got resources that will help a person do that. They need to find out about whether that person ever actually owned the land that's being investigated. And so, you know, I do a lot of that kind of thing behind the scenes, and because I do so much in the way of paranormal talk radio, many of the ghost investigators said, look, you've got to put this into a book for us. And I did the book. I did a business proposal, and Charles River Press offered me a contract to write the book. The book is finished. It's at my publisher's. It'll be out probably around autumn. And the name of the book is Ghost Hunter's Research Guide to Free Internet Sources. And you will not find Ancestry.com in there.
Somehow I'm not surprised.
Okay, so in terms of a tip for where people can go, do you have anything that you can offer at this point for?
Yeah. Anytime you're doing an investigation that has to do with a ghost, and by ghost, there's different definitions of what a ghost is, but to me, I'm speaking of a person who was once alive, as we know, walking the earth.
Right.
Well, you've got to start with their death. And one of the ways that you can start to find out about how they died, where they're buried, is this really fantastic free internet website called Find a Grave. And that URL is www.findagrave.com. Now, you can do this for fun reasons. You can find out where Elvis Presley is actually buried.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but when you get to the front page of Find a Grave, there is a list, and at the bottom of that list, it says Surname Index. If you click the Surname Index, what will come up will be an alpha list of letters. And you can start there if you want to. But one of the problems, unless you have concrete knowledge of how the surname is spelled, and, just think of how many different ways a surname can be spelled. For instance, in Ireland, Kelly was usually spelled with a C.
Yeah.
Because of the hard Celtic C. Then what you may want to do is that right there where the alpha list is, you can also choose to search on the search page. And that's what I recommend that you do. When you get to the search page, it's a really simple kind of name type of a box to where you would put in the last name, the first name, the middle name or middle initial. You can put in any other kind of information, such as if you know the date of death, you could try that. You can search by county or state. The one thing that you always want to be careful of is if you're talking about a woman, you must remember to search under her maiden name, even if she was married. In some population groups, a woman will be buried under her maiden name. And then also you must always think of phonetics, because the further back you go, you're going to find different spellings of really common names. My name, my maiden name, Egan, E-A-G-A-N, most commonly today, that first A is left out. It's simply E-G-A-N. So you'll also find it spelled E-G-G-E-N, and so on and so forth. Every possible phonetic spelling. The thing that this site will help you with is that you can find the grave of the person. Once you find the grave, it tells you where the cemetery is. Now, if you're close enough, the thing to do is to go to that cemetery. When you go to a cemetery and you know where the grave is, if you go when the office is open, they usually have a burial plot file, or it may be called a funeral file, a burial file, and that will have additional information on it about the person. Those files will often tell you who the next of kin is. It may give you the name of the funeral home who handled the burial. It may give you the name of the coroner or the doctor who was the officiant who pronounced the person dead. It may also tell you what religious denomination that the person is. And sometimes, just in finding the grave, you can find out the religious denomination, which brings up another topic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge difference legally between if a person is buried in a cemetery and if they are buried in a graveyard. The further back you go, this becomes more clear, and it's so much more important. Technically, a cemetery is a public burial ground. Anyone can be buried in the cemetery. Now, most cemeteries today are your large memorial parks, and they will have certain sections designated for a religion or even denominations within that religion. If you come across anything that indicates that a person was buried in a graveyard, that means that they had a very specific association to a religious denomination in order to be buried in that graveyard.
Didn't know that.
And so there are red flags here. If you're doing a ghost investigation and you discover that most of the family was buried in this graveyard associated with this particular church, but around the same time, other members of the family were buried in a cemetery, that should be a red flag, because the members who were buried in the cemetery and not the graveyard were buried in that cemetery either by choice, which means they chose to disassociate themselves with that church and denomination, or they were ostracized. They did something that prevented them to be allowed to be buried in the graveyard.
And so they could never rest in peace after that point. But no, that's a good point. That's a very good point, because I think the people nowadays forget how important religion was and how it dominated a lot of aspects of people's lives back then, just as it did not all that long ago, and still does. And that's a very important point.
Yeah, well, the further back you go, and it doesn't have to be that far back. It can be, right up until around World War II. Often it could be a ordained minister who pronounced that person dead, because they were allowed to do so by law. And in some situations, that still is. Everything when it comes to vital records is done on a county by county by county basis. And keep in mind, too, that where a person is buried is not necessarily where they died. They may have been on a cruise ship, and they died on the cruise ship. But, you know, they were brought home, and they were buried closer to town. My father died in Tampa, Florida, but he is buried out here in Southern California.
Right.
You know, so those are the kinds of things that it's like, you know, always remembering to dot your I's and cross your T's.
Uh-huh.
But when you do historical research, if you don't dot that I, someone might misread it as a long E.
Right.
But that's absolutely true, and I think that the parallel there is that, you know, you can make the same kind of mistakes in different areas when you're going about an investigation if you're not focused on detail.
Yeah.
And that's extremely important, that you not overlook it or that you just assume that you got it right. It's going to take more than one reference source a lot of times. I'm sure you'll agree with me, Elizabeth.
Exactly, it does. And since you said assume, I've got to bring up one other topic. When you start digging into how a person died, one of the things that I find is the most misinterpreted, and it's because of a time frame of reference, is the reason or the cause of death. I'm often asked, well, so-and-so died of consumption. They must have been an alcoholic. And if you think about how that word sounds, consumption, it means, you know, did you consume too much of something? But in actuality, consumption means tuberculosis. And by the way, one of the most famous people who died of consumption was Doc Holliday.
Uh-huh.
Okay, he died of tuberculosis. And so I've got this other really great website that can be used, because once again, you cannot assume. I had a great-grandmother who died of bright disease, and that's bright, the opposite of dark. Okay.
The disorder.
Yeah, and that's basically what today could be a kidney disorder. But when she died, she was my great-grandmother, at that time it was sort of a general reference to renal failure, whether
uh-huh.
it was kidney or bladder
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
or even diabetes. Okay.
Yeah, they certainly didn't have the diagnostic tools, and so they did the best they could. We had when I did some genealogical research, I was trying to run down some Civil War ancestors, and had been told by my family, which kind of goes back to what you're saying, how one in the Union was just as great guy, and he was very, you know, wounded and drummed out of the Corps. Well, when I finally got the records from the National Archives, he left the service because he had, excuse me, cirrhosis of the liver and hemorrhoids.
Okay.
You know,
what a combination.
That was kind of, that was really deflating. But I have to tell you, you know, it was the truth. And, you know, it took a while to find it. It took many, many weeks waiting to get the records from the National Archives. But nonetheless, I got a wealth of other material from people that were, at that time, they were providing pensions. So there were affidavits in there from other people in the community, which was just wonderful, all dating to about 1880, 1890, which is really interesting reads.
It is. It's very interesting. When you get those actual documents, one of my great-great-grandfathers was in, well, I'm a Southerner, so I've got all sorts of people in the Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And contrary to stereotypes, this was Central Tennessee, and they were the founders of that area when Tennessee was North Carolina. Well, five brothers, two went into the Union, two went into the Confederacy.
Hmm.
Mine was the one who went into the Union, and come to find out, and he is buried in a national cemetery, and I wrote to the national cemetery, and they sent me a copy of his funeral card. The one thing that was on there that just blew me away is that he had gray eyes. And so you come across these little tidbits of information that can be, I don't know, sort of heartwarming, but at the same time, they add to the personality of the person
mm-hmm.
you're researching.
Yeah.
They put flesh on the bones, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, okay, let me give you this website that's really good for determining the real cause of death. And it is that, you're going to love this. This is a genealogy website. It is Genealogy Quest. And that is www.genealogy.com. GENEALOGY-Quest, QUEST.com. And basically on Genealogy Quest, there are two things I want people to look at. When you get to Genealogy Quest, there is a menu on the left, and I want you to choose glossaries. Okay, then it takes you to a list of glossaries. And basically, there are two glossaries on there that are critical for doing any kind of historical research pertaining to death. One is diseases, and then the other one is epidemics. Now, the one about diseases is going to give you this list of what diseases used to be called, such as consumption. And so, once again, I've got to remind people, regardless of whatever your frame of reference is to a word, I mean, once again, consumption, it's, in this day and age, it's unnatural to assume that the person died of consuming too much of something, and 9 times out of 10, they're going to say alcohol. And so you can never leave it to your present-day
mm-hmm.
frame of reference. Now,
yep.
The other glossary on there is epidemics. And this is what this brings up a topic that ghost investigators have emailed me about. We think of, you know, like the pandemic scare we had last year. That's been going on for eons. And under epidemics, you're going to find out. I mean, there's this chronological list of epidemics going way back in history. But one of them that comes up quite often, especially if you are investigating a paranormal event in a rural area that was rural in the 1920s. And this happens, think of your farmlands, think of your ranches, just think of your rural town. After World War I, our soldiers came back and they brought diseases with them. One of the things that they brought back, we typically have referred to as the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu was an epidemic of huge proportion. It
mm-hmm.
peaked in 1918. Okay, but it was here around 1914, and it continued until around, I've seen people listed as dying of the Spanish flu up until about 1922. Well, I know of paranormal investigators who have investigated areas that today are not rural, because those huge farms and plantations and ranches now have new developments on them. But they researched and they discovered that maybe an entire family was found dead. Well, at that point, it was rural, and often families only went into town on weekends. They went in on Saturday to the general store, and they went in on Sunday to go to church. And by golly, if the reverend didn't see you on Sunday, by Monday he might send somebody out to check on that family. You know, now, and by out, he may only be 5 miles out of town. But when you're talking about a buggy or, you know, a 1920 Ford, 5 miles out of town with the world.
Yeah.
And they would come across a family where everyone died. And, you know, it looked like suspicious circumstances. When in actuality, the Spanish flu could hit, and people could die within 3 to 4 days of getting it.
Yep. A lot of people died, too. A lot of people.
Grandfather's two sisters and a brother died from Spanish flu, and if he had, then somebody else would be hosting this show.
Yeah, it was a big epidemic, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and you know, so that's the other kind of thing, that if you come across a situation where more than one person in a family died, and you're reading obituaries or accounts that it seems suspicious that it was never discovered how they died, they probably died of the Spanish flu, if it was around that time era. But, you know, always check this epidemic list. You know,
let's flip it, Elizabeth. How about if you're a ghost researcher and you're trying to find out about a family that was murdered? My guess would be it'd probably be a lot easier to find information because it was more of a, I don't know, it would probably get more publicity. Is that correct?
Now, that's where find a grave would come in to use.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were all murdered, they were probably all buried on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
The plots are going to be very close together.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to find a grave, and you're doing that kind of search, you want to remember to not just look for one person, you know, but to look for other people with that same name
in the
vicinity. Now, if it happened after 1937, I really need to mention the Social Security Death Index, because once again, this is a government death index. The thing, though, is that Social Security itself is not set up to create a database for people to search. So other people, you know, but this is public information. This is public access information under the Freedom of Information Act. Social Security began around 1937. So from 1937 to present day, you might want to try looking at the Social Security Death Index in addition to find a grave. Okay, there are many places out there that have the index on internet, and it's a really easy search. The one that I love, and I mentioned several in my upcoming book, but for tonight I've got this one that I really love because it's simple to use, and it's by a man named Steve Morse. He has a fantastic search box. His website is http://steve, S-T-E-V-E, Morse, M-O-R-S-E, .org/ssdi/ssdi.html. And Doug, now you know why I sent you those URLs.
Yeah.
They are a mouthful.
I'm going to have to go grab that one, because that one I can't, I'll get it from the email.
Okay. Yeah, that one's a hard one, but I did send these URLs to Doug, and, you know, your audience, they can email me at my website, and I can give it to them there. But before I give out my website, let me tell you about the Social Security Death Index. On the Steve Morse website, what you want to do with his is, let me get my little, where's my note on Steve? Here it is. Okay. That takes you right to his front main page, and it's a search box option. All you have to do is type in the last name, the first name, and if you know the last known address, type that in. Once again, remember to use phonetic spelling. Remember to use a woman's maiden name. The terrific thing about the Social Security Death Index is that from 1937 to present day, deaths are now reported to the Social Security Administration of the government through various sources. And so it's highly unlikely that a person who has died from 1937 to today would not be reported to Social Security, because people, whoever officiated the death, whether it was the doctor or a medical examiner or a coroner, must report it to Social Security. If that person had insurance, whether it's private insurance or military insurance, it is then again reported to Social Security. Any surviving spouse or children must then again report it to Social Security. Hospital administration, if the person died in a hospital, must report it to Social Security. So you've got multiple authorities who are reporting this information to the Social Security Death Index. And it is also a really, really great free authentic website to go to for this kind of thing.
Okay, cool. Well, let me ask you a question from the chat room. One's real quick. I hope it's real quick. Then I have a second one. A while back when we were talking about DNA, just wanted to know what it costs to get DNA testing.
It depends on how far back you want to go. It seems to me that at first we did like a 10-marker DNA. And I think that 10-marker test was about, around, I want to say, $105. Now, the prices have gone down. But when you think about going back, basically each marker is a generation. Oh, my gosh. 10 generations back in that same surname. But go to Family Tree DNA, and, you know, you can find out. Now, the other thing about Family Tree DNA is that you may find out that there is already a surname group going on for the surname that you want tested. And so, you know, that's another option there. There's a whole lot of information on the Family Tree DNA website.
Okay.
If you can go into a surname group and become part of that group, you may, you know, by the time you've got your DNA tested.
That's like hitting a jackpot sometimes.
It is. I mean, you could automatically, yep. You know who you're, they're right there.
Yep. You know. Well, you know, I had that happen to me when I was doing my research. I was going to county historical societies, and when I hit upon one, and here's the real interesting part about it, was that I got a hold of this guy who was the county historian, and started asking him some questions about my ancestor, and come to find out, his great great grandfather, just like my great great grandfather, that were in this particular unit, he had been the company doctor. So, I mean, it's in a weird kind of way. I mean, you know, like the synchronicity about, like, you, it's almost like you're reaching out to try to identify those genes that you carry already and make them, you know, at least with me, make them more human or not seem quite so distant. And you know, that was one of the things that I found really gratifying about it, was the fact that, you know, wow, all of a sudden these pieces, I had worked for about a year before I stumbled across this guy. And then when I did, I got so much information within the space of 24 hours. It was just like an avalanche. And it was just like, wow, I was in hog heaven.
Yes. And, you know, the other thing is that when you're doing that kind of research, whether you're doing it for yourself or you're doing ghost investigation, to this day, it's going to be very difficult for anyone who is not the immediate family member to go and get an official death certificate. Plus, it costs. I mean, you know, out here in California, you can spend $25 for a single death certificate. So when you find a grave or you find anything that connects that person to the funeral home, to a church, to a cemetery, write to them. I have looked all over for a grandmother. I have lots and lots of Texas bones, and they go all over Texas. And I was looking for her way up in the Red River area north of Dallas, and turned out she is buried way, I mean, direct opposite, almost on the Mexican border, in McAllen, Texas. And I spent almost $150 sending away to Texas State Archives to get different death certificates, but they were never her. And I looked.
Well, a lot of people migrated there, too. My ancestors migrated there from Tennessee. As a matter of fact, let's talk a little bit later after the show, because my ancestors came from the same area. On my mother's side, and you know, I know that in the 1830s, around just before the Alamo time, a lot of them were heading to Texas because that was like the promised land.
Well, and actually, there's an area in Texas that was founded by the Tennessee Colony.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your family, Grant, we are probably related.
Could very well be. You know, what a delightful.
Right, a German and an Irish person.
Yeah.
GTT, gone to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Tennessee Colony founded an area kind of. Well, there were two areas. One was near Bowie, Texas, up in northeast Texas, and the other one was around by Palestine.
Uh-huh.
Just a little bit west of Palestine, an area that was once called Bethel, and then it was called Askew.
Uh-huh.
Those are two of the names in my family, by the way.
And, you know, if you've never been to that part of Texas, I was a Midwesterner most of my life until a little bit later when I was in the military. And, you know, I really liked that part of Texas and Eastern Texas was very, very, I'm not sure, I can't recall if that if Palestine is in Eastern Texas.
Yeah.
But there's parts of Texas that I kind of pictured as a kid growing up with cowboy movies. And although it is, it's still very beautiful country in many places. There's other places that are desert, but in some of the spots I've been, it's been lovely.
Eastern Texas is bayou country.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like Louisiana, and it's the big piney woods.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful area. We go there. In fact, we may retire there, but that goes a ways in the distance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there, you know what? I know we're getting really close, and there's one other thing I want to mention, because this also deals with authentic records, and it has to do with land. Okay, keep in mind how the United States of America, as we see it today, was founded. It was founded first under parishes, going back to the James River area. And people, the reason I'm mentioning James River is that you have been, through media, you have come to believe that it was the Pilgrims who were here first. And people along the James River in Virginia were planting tobacco before the Pilgrims ever set sail. So that's the reason I'm mentioning the James River area. It began with plantations and parishes. And then it went out from plantations after the Revolutionary War into pioneering all that area west of the 13 colonies. Okay. Everything that is Kentucky and West Virginia today was originally part of Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Everything that is Tennessee today was originally part of North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
You look at a map of present-day United States and look at your eastern seaboard and go west from there. And that's how the U.S. was pioneered.
Yep, that was almost the all Northwest Territory. And if you look at, like you're pointing out, Elizabeth, those states, their boundaries heading west just were open all the way through.
It's
probably
open.
The easiest way to survey it, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we considered, at that time, we considered Missouri the far west.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
yeah.
You know, that's the Mississippi River, and
that's
pretty much. But anyway, the point I'm getting to is that all of that was pioneered on land grants that were awarded to Revolutionary War patriots for their service. We were broke after the Revolutionary War.
Uh-huh.
So the only way they could pay their patriots was to give them land bounty deeds.
Uh-huh.
This website that I have will help you find those original land patent records. And this is through the United States Bureau of Land Management. The URL is www.glorecords.blm.gov/. And what you are looking for here is that you can let me grab my notes on that. I didn't know we would get quite this far. Here we go. Okay. What you can do here is that you can select from the state list, type in the last name, first name if you have it, and click search. Now, by a state list, we're talking about present-day states. But as I said, keep in mind that Tennessee was North Carolina. Kentucky was Virginia. You know, that kind of thing. And I'll tell you how this was used very recently. Some investigators had contacted me, and they were in, I forget, it was one of the southern states. I want to say it was Mississippi, but it could have been Alabama. And they said that they were investigating a home, a present-day modern home, a suburb, who the the residents were claiming that the original plantation owner from the 1800s had either written his name, like, in the fog on a window or in the dust of the windowsill. I forget. And I said, well, I can tell you how to get his signature. I said, go to this website, type in the name. If they think they know the original plantation owner's name, go ahead and type that name in. And what comes up on this website is not an extract. It is not a transcript. It is a photographic image of the exact document. And sure enough, they did this, and up came this original land patent record that was the first deed to this plantation owner. It was dated 1803.
Wow.
And there is his signature. And so the ghost investigator was able to say, I'm sorry, but whoever is writing this name, it is not the original plantation owner. And so, you know, the truth is out there, you know, and the truth, it is really what all investigators are going for. You're going for the truth.
Well, let me ask you a question in connected to that one, that example you just gave. This is a question from the Inception Radio Network chat room from Richard. Have you been involved in any cases where genealogical or historical research has actually helped to prove that ghosts are real? If so, can you tell us about such a case?
Well, you know, I often tell people that if you feel that there is a ghost, a presence, a spiritual spirit presence, that one of the first things you should try to do is eliminate that it isn't one of your own ancestors. Now, this is very much a Celtic belief, but you'll find this kind of same belief among many of the tribes of American Native Indians, is that your ancestors are your spirit guides. And if it is an ancestor, you kind of want to keep that person around, and chances are you may have misinterpreted why they are there because you don't understand it.
Right.
So I would say in a situation like that, yes. Real quick, it had to do with a farm up in, typical farm country. Maybe it was Iowa, someplace up there. But the investigator had contacted me, and it was a family who was living on the historic farm that had belonged to the great-great-grandparents who first patented the land. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a child, and it's very difficult if you're dealing with a child, but the child was describing this person who was a ghost who basically had a huge hay pick. Now, to a child of 6 years old, something holding a hay pick is the devil, because you've got to think of that child's frame of reference. I gave them some websites to go to, and they went to these websites. They discovered that the person was probably the great-great-grandfather, because he had won, and he was known for doing this, for winning hay baling contests.
All right.
Okay.
So he wasn't the son of the devil after all.
No, and so, you know, that's a kind of a classic thing.
Yeah, but that's great,
though. You cannot assume based on our present day of reference, especially with children, because they're getting their frame of reference from cartoons and Disney.
Yep.
All right, so let's, Elizabeth, tell everybody your website again.
Okay, my website is my name. It is www.elizabethegan, E-A-G-A-N, Cox, C-O-X, dot net.
Okay, and you've got your books available there
as
well? Okay.
Well, yeah, I don't sell my books. I'm a traditional author, but I do have links to them.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, go visit Elizabeth's website. Some great tips that you've given tonight. We really appreciate that. We appreciate you taking your time.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, thank you for having me. And, you know, when my next book comes out, I may be contacting you. I'd love to come back with more great websites.
Yes.
Sure.
Good.
Sure. We'd love to have you come back, too. We can always use somebody that's well-grounded in historical research.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, and have a great
our
night.
Pleasure.
But thanks for joining us. And to our listeners, some great websites, some great information from Elizabeth tonight. If you're not familiar with those, go check those out. They're in the chat room, but if you're listening to the archive, you'll want to re-listen and find those. We appreciate everybody's time tonight. We're pretty much out of time. Next week, we have Crop Circles with Patty Greer. It should be an interesting show. Please visit us at Paranexus.org. We'd love to have you join us as members. We appreciate everybody listening live tonight, not only in our Blog Talk Radio chat room, but in the Inception Radio chat room as well. And that's all I got, Grant.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. It's always nice to have you with us. And thanks again, Elizabeth. Everybody have a wonderful weekend coming up, and we look forward to seeing you next Wednesday night.
Happy Cinco de Mayo. Good night.
Yay! Ay, que rico.